Yes, yes. Canadians committing war crimes, but politely.
We are here to burn down your home. Is there anything you would like to take?
Yeah. Please
help you haul it out.
God, I love Canada.
We will be burning down your home, but we will help you move first.
Welcome or welcome back to The Buck Starts Here, the podcast that digs deep into juicy stories, power plays, and wild twists that shape the presidencies of the United States. I'm Kyle to Eric Stan, and Joel, my adopted Canadian brother, has agreed to represent his country as we dig a little deeper into the events of 1812. Before we do that, though, let's get some shameless plugs out of the way. If you are listening, you should be subscribed to The Buck Starts Here in your favorite app. We're on all of them, including YouTube, especially if you want to watch instead of just listen. Eric, what about you, man? You got something you want to plug, promote? Joel, any of you guys?
If you're in the Boston area, I'm speaking at Titan Investors. They're having, I think it's one of their quarterly conferences. So I'll be speaking there in March, and then I'll be in the World Finance Forum down in Dallas. So if you want to come and just heckle me, I'm on a panel.
Did we get you any hecklers last time?
No, everybody's always really nice to you in person.
Man, I've been trying, man. I've been really trying.
Yeah, it's sad. I want people to be a little meaner.
I just want someone to come and pepper you with bricks questions.
I thought you were going to say pepper me with bricks, and I was like, wow.
That'd be a completely different Q&A session. Joel, you got anything you want to plug or promote while you're here?
Come see the Rockies in Alberta.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Come see them all. I'm sitting outside the CN Towers. You don't want to plug the view from on top of Toronto?
I've never been to Toronto.
So when we get to the next recording, we're gonna have to talk about how badly Canada has been just relying on Alberta to keep its economy afloat. But
Harry.
But this should be about some more interesting aspects of an event that happened during Madison's presidency. So Eric, I don't know if you want to set the stage here on this one.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're going to be talking about the War of 1812, and to no surprise, it begins in 1812. Specifically, it was the first war ever declared by the United States. So the Revolutionary War, obviously, we hadn't been formed yet, but we didn't declare war on the Brits under this current Constitution. So this is the first time that the idea of war had really come to the U.S. And Madison, on June 18th, 1812, went to Congress and they got approval and declared war on England.
I didn't actually realize it was us that declared war on England. I thought that they declared on us. Or were, like, how did that actually, like, how did we get to that point?
So there was this practice going on called impressment of
That's
American
right.
sailors.
That's right.
And basically the British Navy was taking American sailors from U.S. ships. Sometimes it gets taught a little weird, as if they were Navy officers and, you know, Navy seamen who were taken off Navy vessels. No, it was like a cargo ship getting stopped by the Brits, and they'd be like, ooh, you guys are pretty good sailors, like, and then taking them. Britain was also, this is also kind of the Embargo Act and the Non-Intercourse Act that we saw under Jefferson and under early Madison.
Can we talk about the Non-Intercourse Act, or did we already talk about that?
We talked about it a little bit under Jefferson.
Okay.
So basically you had the Embargo Act, which nobody could trade with anybody, and the Non-Intercourse Act was like, nobody trade with England or France.
Okay, that's a trade deal.
Yep.
It doesn't sound like one.
Yeah, and then under Madison, we'll get into this more during Madison's presidency, because it's a little interesting, but Congress and Madison basically got together and said, like, the first nation to trade with them, England or France, they'll trade with them.
Mm-hmm.
And then they won't trade with the other. That's a whole weird, hinky area that I don't know how that constitutionally stood up in the long run. But again, the conversation a little outside of the War of 1812. But British interference with trade is a big one. The Brits also flooded different Native American tribes with weapons. And there's something called Tecumseh's Confederacy. And they just fought a lot of bloody wars in Ohio. Like a lot of bloody wars in Ohio. And then Henry Clay and John C. Calhoun. Henry Clay, I'd argue, is the most influential man in U.S. politics who never became president. Pressured Madison to declare war as a sign of, like we're not going to take this from the Brits. On June 1st of 1812, James Madison writes a letter to Congress requesting, you know, war, a declaration of war. And about 2 weeks later, they voted and they voted to go to war.
Wow.
The War of 1812 has a lot of interesting aspects to it, and we'll dive into the military side of it. But from an economic standpoint, there was something called the Hartford Convention that showed up, and that was a bunch of Northeastern people who didn't want to fight this war because they didn't see it. They didn't see the solution to this being war, like an all-out war with Britain, and it hurt a lot of their trade deals. So they got together and like were trying to form this kind of quasi-nullification. And nullification had already been discussed. So nullification's earlier in the U.S. history. Nullification has already been discussed. Nullification is the concept that a state can nullify a federal law.
Oh, we've kind of gone through some of that with like trying to legalize marijuana and other things, right?
Oh, yeah. That's why like it's hard for a lot of the cannabis industry to grow is because you have there's an irony of that word I just said, that phrasing.
Yeah, grow. That's pretty good.
Yeah, because like you can't hold money at FDIC. Organization.
Right.
The Hartford Convention actually led to the Federalist Party being dissolved because people saw them as traitors for wanting to leave. I don't want to say like it gets painted as a secession movement, like the Northeast was going to leave the United States. I don't really think that's what it was. It was more just like they weren't going to be active participants in the war. So they get labeled as traitors and the Federalist Party dies and another party doesn't rise up until the Whig Party almost 30-ish years later. So that's why Madison's also considered the first president of the era of good feeling, is because there was literally not another political party since Democratic Republicans.
There was strife good there. Feeling.
Yeah, it is funny that the most contentious election of all time, the election of 1824, was done between two people of the same party, John Quincy Adams and Andrew Jackson. That's kind of funny.
That one was worse than the John Adams Thomas Jefferson election?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, like, people died. Like, there was, like, really, like a lot of people, like, the Peggy Eaton affair, like, took years off people's lives. I think one of them, somebody died from that. Yeah. At the end of the day, don't forget, Jefferson and Adams were still friends. Even, like, I don't know, I say weird stuff to my friends, I'm sure you guys do.
Yeah, it's fair.
But, yeah, so Madison didn't want to do the War of 1812, but Henry Clay and John C. Calhoun and a lot of the war hawks in Congress wanted to go to war. They wanted to really show their, you know, how good, yeah, the U.S. could stand up.
How much
it didn't go well. It did not stand well.
How much was Canada involved with this?
Pretty much heavily. It was really the war of the U.S. versus Canada and Native Americans. The Brits, yeah, they dominated the sea. Don't get me wrong. Relatively dominated the sea in the ocean, but it was troops in Canada, it was British troops in modern day Canada that fought the war. It really just went so bad. Like, I don't even.
So, Canada has, like, Joel, correct me if I'm wrong, but there's a very large population of French speaking Canadians. You guys were kind of like split colonized, right? You have French colonists and English colonists. Right. So, when did that like change? Like, when did the French like leave? Or I guess they never really left.
Still
but...
here.
Yeah, their bosses. When did their bosses leave?
Joel, that was great.
Yeah.
Quebec is still very French.
Yes, yes.
And I think that even parts of Ontario still have like quite a population of French, but the majority of the rest of Canada is English and English speaking.
Mm-hmm.
And even the French that are here now, are like, I think that even their way they speak French, they have almost a different language than France.
So it's kind of like the French that we have in New Orleans, where they kind of have that...
Creole.
Yeah, Creole.
Could be. I don't actually know that.
Yeah, I'd imagine it's probably something similar to that.
It's like they're now like a French Canadian versus like a French from France, I guess, would be the way to put it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
But they never left. They're still very much here.
So, but were they involved too? Was France involved still at this point with Canada's history, or is France like gone from the picture?
No, so France is relatively gone, and that's actually why a lot of people think the war happened in 1812. It probably could have happened a lot earlier. But it was actually the defeat of Napoleon, and then that freed up a lot of British resources to then go wage war in the U.S.
That makes sense.
The Louisiana Purchase is a big reason why there's no more French governance in in Canada is because part of that treaty, they basically, like, long story short, part of that treaty is that France, you know, seceded a lot of its territory because, like, they took a big hit after the Seven Years' War. And then, like, the Spanish administration of the Louisiana Territory, then the eventual sale, and actually it was, like, they basically only saw it as a commercial hub. Mm-hmm. If Napoleon didn't exist, which I guess sounds kind of weird, but if Napoleon wasn't around, the war probably would have started in 1807. So the HMS Leopard, it attacked the USS Chesapeake. I think we talked about this during the Jefferson Quasi-War episode. And that was the first instant of impressment, of, like, really impressment. So that was Thomas Jefferson was like, screw you guys, embargo act, destroy the U.S. economy.
Yeah.
And then after that, like, Clay and Calhoun and those guys were like, if this ever happens again, we're going to war. And then 1811, there was a Native American chief named Tecumseh. He had something called the Tecumseh Native American Confederacy. That's what it's called a lot in research. I actually don't know what's, like, the modern, if that's a modernized term. But it was called Tecumseh's Confederacy is how it's usually referred to. And there was the Battle of Tippecanoe and Tyler,
Yeah,
too.
Yeah.
And William and Harrison pretty handedly defeated Tecumseh. And the Brits weren't super pumped about that because the best way to think of them were kind of like what the Mujahideen were in the 80s and 90s in Afghanistan, how the U.S. was, like, not, like, I mean, I'm sure there's probably Green Berets and people, stuff I don't know about because I'm just a regular American Joe. They're supporting the Mujahideen. But that was basically what the Brits were doing with this Tecumseh Confederacy. And then it got beat pretty bad. It was pretty, pretty awful, to be honest. So
they were arming the natives to try to push out the oppressive Americans.
See, this
basically,
was
a, right?
So the territory.
Or were they just trying to just cause chaos just because they're still mad?
Yeah, the Brits gave no craps about Native American people. Oh, no, this yeah, isn't. Yeah. No. This is more about stopping them from us continuing to go west. But I want to point some out here. This is 1811. We already bought Louisiana.
Right.
It's already our territory. Right. So this goes on, and, like, pretty much all throughout 1811 into mid-1812. This is just going on. There's all these skirmishes with Tecumseh's Confederacy and stuff like that and remnants of it. So finally the U.S. is like, we're done with this. And the United States declares war. And the next month later in July, General William Hull, he's like, I'm going to go invade Canada from Detroit. So he leaves from Detroit. Almost immediately surrenders. I want to give a timeline here. So he leaves, like, mid-ish July of 1812. On August 16th, he hands over Detroit to the British.
Not only did he not win, but he actually lost ground.
Yeah, like a major, major city. Just immediately loses. Like, I don't even, like, it's not that he left and lost. He lost so bad, so he got pushed back, and he was like, here's a city. Which, I hate to say, but that's absolutely hilarious.
That was kind of like a big moment, though, having those troops in Detroit, because didn't the Navy, like, push them out in the Great Lakes? And
Do you think I would not come prepared with stories of the battles of the Great Lakes?
You better have some good stories.
Damn Navy friend. Are you serious?
Baby.
Let's roll with that. So the first major battle we have in the Great Lakes, I have my notes up because I did a lot of homework on these because it's actually a lot of, like, Navy dudes will just write. Like, there's so many dudes who, like, went to school after the Navy and got great degrees in history and stuff like that who are just like, I'm writing about the War of 1812. I don't care if nobody's going to read it.
Sounds like a Navy guy.
Well, here's the thing. These books are beautifully written. I mean, amazing. And they have no citations. Like, they have no citations. Like, nobody's actually reading them.
That sounds like a Navy guy.
I just assume it's a bunch of just Navy people being like, this is sick. So the first battle we have is the Battle of Lake Erie. And this is what forced the British to retreat from Detroit. So the Brits get in there. So August 16th, Hull surrenders, and, you know, the Brits take over Detroit. October 13th, the U.S. is defeated at the Battle of Queenston Heights. But interesting thing here. There was a British general, Isaac Brock, is killed in battle. Mm-hmm. And a funny thing about this is that the U.S. You got to remember, this is 40 years, almost 40 years after the Revolutionary War fought. So this isn't like, nobody there is commanding these troops. But the Brits had been told about how the U.S. is like, well, you know, targets officers. And then they went and fought in the Napoleonic War. So all these guys are Napoleonic War fighters. So they're used to like the large formations and, you know, there's no such thing as chivalrous war. That's a lie.
But it's the rank and file stand in front of each other and just shoot volleys until somebody gives up.
Exactly. So that's what they were. So that's like what they were doing.
Okay.
And then they come over here, and the first major land battle, somebody pops off one of the highest ranking generals in the British Army, and it's like, wow. Oh, they learned from their dads. Take out the guy with the fancy hat. And that, my friends, is why we have an important NCO corps in the United States.
That makes sense.
So this, so you end up with August, and so you end up with October, but basically August to December ish, the U.S. on the land is just doing horrible. The Brits, the Canadians, are beating the crap out of us. But then September 10th, 1813, the U.S. notches its first victory. Kyle, do you have to learn like Navy history when you're
a little bit?
I often wondered if this guy's famous, Oliver Hazard Perry.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. There's a ton of stuff that we learned about him. Yeah. Is he Damn the Torpedoes, Full Steam Ahead guy, or is that a different one?
That'd be a different guy.
I think that's a different one.
The only reason I said is I don't think they had torpedoes or steam.
Well, no, torpedoes was mines or something different.
Oh, that's right.
They
meant
that completely different. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so maybe we'll do a fact check on that.
That's Admiral David Farragut during the Civil War Battle of Mobile Bay. My bad.
Close.
Not even. So, yeah, they taught us some of that history, but not very well.
That is funny. So.
Perry is a name that definitely stood out, though. They definitely talked about him.
Yeah, like Hazard is just an awesome name.
Yeah.
So you had the Battle of Lake Erie. By the way, it is funny because the end goal, what ends up happening at the War of 1812 is the part of the treaty that ends the war is the demilitarization of the Great Lakes, which mm-hmm. are now like one of the largest centers of commerce in the entire world. So the Brits have 6 warships. We have 9 warships, including the USS Lawrence and the USS Niagara, which are pretty good ships for their time. And the Brits get taken to task. Like, Perry's a lunatic. He's chasing these guys, like, anywhere he can find them. The USS Lawrence basically gets, like, almost destroyed. Perry had actually, he was on the USS Niagara. He was on the USS Lawrence when the battle started. It gets destroyed because he's just driving around trying to hit everybody. He ends up rowing his boat to the USS Niagara to continue the fight. It was just overpowered. He ends like his like I don't know, like the report. I don't know if they called it at the time, whatever the report is, they would write. He had some very famous. He had a saying today. He's like, "We have met the enemy, and they are ours." That's this guy's mentality. Yep. This guy's pumped. So now they control Lake Erie. They cut off the British supply lines, and the Brits are forced to abandon Detroit, and the U.S. regains it. Funny thing, there was never a Battle of Detroit. It was taken without violence and given up without violence.
I think what's fascinating is that, yeah, all of the army gains were based off of military or Navy victories. Like they didn't, yeah, nobody had to fire a shot, just take away their supply chain and they just leave. Don't have to worry about it.
Yeah, exactly. And to continue that discussion, so afterwards, Perry, there's a big victory on like Erie. William Henry Harrison, the guy who becomes president, he's like, "I'm going to go into Canada again." And everybody's like, "Dude, what are you doing?" Like, "What are you doing?" Stop going into Canada. It's not working out for anybody. So he's like, "I'm going to go into Canada." So this is by the time he gets into Canada, by the time like he raises the army, gets up there, it's October 5th, 1813. The Brit, he shows up. The Brits actually didn't have that strong of a resistance. They kind of like let Tecumseh and his troops, like the native allies is how it's referred to a lot, like to go fight it. Mm-hmm. And which was weird to me because if you're the Brits, you're like, dude, a year ago or two, a year and a half ago, William Henry Harrison came up here and like kicked your butt, like not a close victory. And so they set him out for a second time, and Tecumseh actually gets killed in the battle. Again, high-ranking person getting on the opposing side, get taken out.
We're pretty good at that.
Yeah, we are really good at that. So, long story short, this ends up closing out the war. The battle secures the Northwest for the U.S. And by Northwest, I mean like Ohio, Michigan, like that area. Illinois, Indiana. Actually, I don't know how involved Indiana was in there. Little northern parts of Indiana. And the British... British influence in that area never rose again throughout the rest of the war.
What's interesting is I actually went to when, was it Nick Mason, I think, the drummer for Pink Floyd, was doing a show in Indianapolis. Laura and I went up there, but they had a really cool war museum there that just every single war that the U.S. has ever fought, going all the way back to the French and Indian War, they had all of like the Indiana connection to that, like all the Indianapolis people who fought in every single war all the way up to like modern day. So,
yeah, I'm
pretty sure
stuff.
1812 stuff was in there. I just don't remember it.
I just think that's so cool.
Yeah.
I love that stuff. But now we get to the part. Now we get to the bad part. one of the bad parts of this story. So, afterwards, the U.S. is like, this is great. So, they launch the Battle of Lake Ontario. And it's pretty standard fare. The U.S. launches naval raids all into the York area, which is, I think it's still called York in Toronto. Like, I think there's a neighborhood that might be called New York. It's like Old Town, but it's Toronto. And the U.S. does a pretty solid job. Like it maintains great position in the Great Lakes. It's able to really influence. You know, nobody ever really has full control of Lake Ontario because, I mean, people are familiar with maps. It's a lot easier to defend like Lake Erie than it is to defend Lake Ontario if you're thinking of it that you're coming from the U.S. But the Americans get the bright idea to march into Toronto and burn all the government buildings to the ground. And they were like, this will never come back to to bite us.
So kind of was a little bit our fault.
No, 100%.
Yeah, okay.
It was our fault. Right. So we burned down. Again, only government buildings. So that's, by the way, the burning of D.C. and the burning of Toronto, or York at the time it was called, it was just government buildings. They didn't burn down. Like, they were just, like, pillaging. We'll get more into that a little bit later. The last, like, kind of major, what I would call, like, strategic maneuvering as it goes, not major strategic maneuvering, but the next chapter in this, is on September 11th, 1814. So it's almost a year after William Henry Harrison, almost a year after William Henry Harrison has his famous victory in Canada and kind of permanently weakens the offensive ability of England, the Brits, I should say, to go into the United States at the time. So you have the Battle of Lake Champlain, and it's an invasion. It's on the New York side of it. And they go to, the Brits go to invade down through New York, kind of make a direction from towards D.C., but not really, just kind of moving into that area. And the Navy bails out the Army again. there's Commodore Thomas McDonough. His fleet shows up and just hands him a pretty hefty defeat. It was a very,
thank
very overwhelming
God
defeat.
For the Navy, John Adams.
It was.
Can we go back and give him another point for foresight?
I mean, it really was. It really was funny because throughout this entire throughout the entire time, it's important to remember that there's always this dialogue of, you know, should we have a standing army? Should we have troops around? Did Thomas Jefferson weaken the Navy a little bit? Yes, but a lot of people were like, dude, you need a Navy. Like, everybody was like, you need a Navy?
Yeah.
So you have all these successful battles, right? You're the Navy's dominating, all that stuff. It's all going good. And what's important to remember is that, like, the Brits at the time, they're good fighters, right? It's just that their supply lines are insane. I mean, for this time in history, that's an insane timeline to manage.
Insane good or insane bad?
Oh, and same, the distance, difficult. Just tyranny of distance.
Right. No, there's no infrastructure, there's no roads, there's no railways.
Right. You're
trying to get troop supplies. Like, really, I think most of the time, troops are living off the land or whatever they can plunder from the lands that they're, you know, invading.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so they end up, but what ends up becoming important is coastal defenses. So the U.S. almost has this, like, understanding where it's like, oh my, wow, we were able to use naval forces to submit, for all intents and purposes, submit a incredibly powerful army. And it was because if you're in a boat firing cannon shot at people on the ground, you can't retaliate against that. You're like, oh, that, like, even if you have cannons, like, the cannons aren't even remotely on the same scale. And this was also the first war that we saw the use of explosive shells. So in the Star-Spangled Banner, the bombs bursting in air, those were the first, really the first explosive shells, naval used explosive shells. So
is that why there's cannons in the Overture of 1812?
I'm assuming. I don't have the. I'm not sure. You may stump me on that one.
Right. It's a classic orchestral piece, but there's usually like cannons that get fired off, I think, in that, like, at some point.
Like, inside the theater, would that?
I never watched it perform, so I couldn't speak to that, but I assumed. Like, I don't think they were, like, you know, firing cannonballs, but I mean,
blanks.
Blanks, yeah.
You can put blanks in back, yeah. Right?
Imagine that. Show up at a concert.
we were firing off some ceremonial howitzers when we opened up one of our parks, or like our general's park, and I was walking out of City Hall as it fired, it, like, the air difference when those things go off, because it was right beside the building. I was like, oh, that's terrifying. That is. I don't want to hang out with that.
I could hear and feel the pressure change when we launched a torpedo on our submarine, even if I was in the back half of the boat, just from the air pressure flinging that thing out through the tube.
Oh, that's terrifying.
Right?
That's terrifying. Just imagine you're just, like, sitting on a shore getting bombarded. So coastal defenses become, like, wildly, wildly important after this war. And then on the ocean side, obviously there's a lot of battles on there. Most of those battles are very, very famously known. But obviously, being a Bostonian, I have to talk about the greatest naval battleship of all, or the greatest naval ship of all time.
Constitution?
USS Constitution.
Things a unit.
Yeah, it's a. it is huge to think about what that must have looked like 250 years ago when she was made.
I just think about how crazy it is. The wood that they used is so much denser than any other wood that was used to make ships at the time, right? So the cannonballs are just bouncing off the sides of it.
Yeah, live wood oak. The Navy actually maintains a forest in Indiana just to repair that ship.
Right.
The entire forest.
I think I have a pen from it. Is this it? Yes. I don't know if you can see that on the camera there.
Oh, that's so cool.
No.
Almost.
Anyway, that's a pen from made from pieces of the wood that they repaired. So when they tear up the deck and they make pens out of it to give away to sell to help fund it. Thought that was kind of neat.
Oh, that's awesome.
Right?
My favorite joke of all time in the USS Constitution, Tiffany and I are taking one of our really good friends from England to see it, like to see all the stuff in Boston. And she gets up to the front and, you know, you get to go on the boat, you have to show your ID. So the only ID she has is her passport. And so she hands her British passport to the naval officer. Ooh. And he looks at it and goes, I don't think I'm allowed to let you on here. And then he immediately starts apologizing because he's like, I'm supposed to be doing, like, serious security. And I just made a War of 1812 joke. Something I learned interesting. So I fell down a rabbit hole researching this episode because I did not realize. I thought there was a specific battle that gave the USS Constitution's nickname of Old Ironsides.
Oh, there wasn't?
No, it was.
I thought so too.
Yeah, I always thought so. She defeated the HMS Guerrieri in a battle. I always thought that's where it came from, and a lot of historians point to that specific battle. That's where she got her name. But there was already there's evidence that name was used before,
mm-hmm.
a little bit that concept of Old Ironsides. So. Yeah, but that nickname, pretty funny. It that it was after that battle became famous, but there are some which appear to be accurate primary sources where they started talking about her hull being almost of a maiden of iron is a term that was used a couple times. You
would
think that
the people building the ship would probably have some sort of understanding of what they're dealing with. If you're trying to put a nail through that, you might have some sort of understanding, right?
Like, I hate this material.
Yeah.
Horrible. Somebody invent some sort of electricity.
Do you think that they use that just because that's what was available, or was there intent behind it?
Yeah, so Livewood Oak, which is the type of tree that is really why the Brits colonized this area of the world, was just well known for being incredibly strong. It's when you go to the USS Constitution Museum, they actually have all the different oaks, all the different types of trees, and what they were built with at that time, and they have one of Livewood Oak, and it feels like you're holding concrete. You're just like, wow. And then they, obviously, people were building boats out of pine, battleships out of pine.
Yeah.
But they actually have pine, because I think most people know what pine is, and you're like, oh, these aren't even the same species.
Right. No. Like, what about African ironwood? Is that, how does our oak compare to that?
I would, surprisingly, that is outside my depth of knowledge.
I just thought you knew everything, I'm sorry.
That would be wild. Well, actually, I'm a tetralogist.
Yeah.
That's one of those words.
Up while you guys are talking.
Yeah. Well, it's a good time for us to start talking, because we've entered the end game of the war.
Ooh.
The burning Washington, D.C. Damn it, Joel. You and your nice Canadian friends came down here and burnt a bunch of buildings down.
Aggression will be met with aggression.
Yeah. Joel, people think...
Here's your moment, Joel.
I have a question for you, though. The question that I have for you is... When was the Canadian independence from Britain?
Oh, probably sometime in the 20s.
It was not in 1812, though. It was definitely well after that, if I remember correctly.
It was like 1920s or something like that.
How can you be blaming Canadians for doing this, then?
Well, I mean, the U.S. gets blamed for everything. Like, if we blame programs for stuff, why can't I blame Canadians for this? I mean, that seems unfair.
It just seems like this is more of a Britain thing than a Canadian thing.
Is it? But where did the Brits come from? I mean, where did the Canadians come from? Are you guys just descendants of the Brits? If I get blamed for stuff that we did before we were a country, you get blamed for doing stuff that before you were a country. All right, that's the game, yeah?
That's almost fair, but I'm actually Irish and German.
I know, right?
Oh, okay. You want to... Okay, we're having that discussion.
That's even worse. All right. So you are a blame.
If you want to have a go, it's a different one.
So do you just, like, wash your hands of, like, everything Germany did in, like, the 1880s? You're like, oh, that doesn't count. We are Prussia.
Right, yeah, exactly.
That's right.
Just don't look at the Berlin. The Berlin Conference wasn't a German failure. That was the Prussian failure.
I wasn't around for that.
I'm just saying it's a little hard to say. I think it's a little disingenuous to blame Canadians for burning down the White House when they weren't actually Canadians at the time.
Oh, I'm sorry. Were you expecting me to be genuine? That's not how this is. I will push a narrative for my advantage.
All right, I'll let you go.
He hangs up on me.
Yeah, right. No, I didn't mean like that. I meant I'll let you go on.
I assume, Joel, that the burning of Washington, D.C., which, I'm assuming the Canadians view that as quite a moment of pride currently. I assume you guys celebrate that every day?
No.
You don't have a party
every
on
other day.
Like, what is Canada doing on August 24th? Like, you guys celebrate that?
No.
I think you should.
I think you should.
I really do think you should. Call it Retribution Day. Righteous Fury Day. Well, I mean, if we just went and tried to destroy Toronto, I mean, it serves us right. You know?
That is true.
Yeah. I think you guys should be celebrating it as the day you put America in its place.
See, that was
a weird way to word that. I love it.
Sit down.
Right. I'm taking these away.
My favorite part about it is there was no strategic value to it. They were just really angry that we burnt down the capital of Canada. And they were like, do what? Well, York was Toronto was functioning as the capital of Canada at that time. And they're like, we're going to burn down your stuff. It's like, oh.
mean. Canada's like that, though, right? I think we kind of do.
Yeah, you were criminals.
Just, like, we're fine until you do something to us. Then we're going to throw cans.
I really feel. At you,
followed by grenades.
I feel like it's America's job is to stop Canada from just. We're just. Our goal is to shield the rest of the world from Canada. Canada's like our dog that we let loose when. Something really goes down. Like, we need to get Nazis out of Germany. Like, we're getting Canada involved. Canada, this is your job.
Yeah, I always feel like Canada is one of those countries that, like, I'm happy they're not at war a lot because you guys have no gradiency to what you do.
I'm so happy they're our friends.
Yeah, you guys either, like, okay, no, we're going to, like, you know, have a pretty robust economy, do a bunch of good stuff, try and solve the housing crisis in Canada at some point. And then it's like, oh, wartime. It's like, oh. Time to commit crimes. No escalation.
All's fair in war.
Just like every story I've ever read about like Canadians at war, I'm just like, I'm very happy that A, you're our friends, and B, you're just not, you don't border any other countries. You border one country. New conspiracy theory. The reason the U.S. has the most powerful military on Earth is because it borders Canada. We need to convince you guys not to start.
I like it.
Yeah, so the burning of DC was really interesting because the Brits, you know, they land. It's they first land in Benedict, Maryland. They come up the I can never pronounce the word, and I've driven over that river 100 times. Patoxent River.
Potomac.
So, not Potomac. P A T U X E N T.
Nah, forget it. That
yeah, just
put, it, put the word up on the screen and just move on.
So they live with like 4,500 troops, and a lot of them had just left the Napoleonic Wars. So these guys are like, these are top end troops. So there's this U.S. General William Winder, and he starts preparing defenses. And even James Madison, who was very sickly, he was a sick guy in general. But this war like really exacerbated everything. But he even came out to inspect the troops. And then they start, after the troops get on the ground, get settled. So they finish unloading all the troops on August 21st. But on August 23rd, the Brits start marching towards Bladensburg, which is kind of like the last military outpost at the time, right outside D.C., where a battle ensues. There's 6,500 Americans who are not the regulars. It's all militias. And they battle on the eastern branch of the river that cuts through Bladensburg. It's a pretty handed defeat, you know.
You said the Brits came in from Maryland. This isn't the same expedition that came in and trashed New York? This is a different...
No. The New York expedition got defeated. Okay. This is a much smaller force, relatively. But pretty much happens that every time they try to move large amounts of troops, they would have to use ships, and the U.S. Navy would curb stomp them, like beat the ever-living crap out of them. And then, right. Like, the Brits would come into, like, Baltimore, where you have the Battle of Fort McHenry, and they just couldn't break down the forts. And then they would run into, like, the USS Constitution. You have these massive frigates, and they couldn't muster enough forces because we were playing defense on the coast, offense in the lakes, and that was just messing up. Like, England would have had to amass an armada to break through to be able to land enough troops. And they just fought one of the bloodiest wars in human history against Napoleon.
Did they lose Nelson too? One of those battles? I mean, yeah, they're still hurting from that.
Yeah, so they just basically said, like, we can't really do anything there. So you end up, the U.S. military, the U.S. militias get defeated. I will say, cool, when I read this great book that was actually written, this great paper that was written like the 1860s, late 1860s, that was on American artillery usage during that during that battle, the Battle of Bladensburg, Bladensburg. That's a weird word to say. But they withering artillery, like withering artillery. And one thing that shook the militias was that these battle-hardened, these Napoleonic War troops, which is an argument to make the Napoleonic War is the first modern war. So these guys saw way more advanced warfare. They almost felt like going back in time.
Yeah, Napoleon was like the cutting edge of artillery.
Yes.
Like he grew up in the artillery corps. That's where he cut his teeth in his military career. He was very, very ahead of the game as far as utilizing that. So yeah, they would come in over to face us, and our artillery is probably just like laugh at that.
Yeah, and they march through it, and that's really what caused the rout.
Just march through. Oh man, yeah, that's actually terrifying.
Yeah, it ended up being called Bladensburg Race, and that was the militia fleeing. It left Washington D.C. defenseless.
So as an American, you just pissed off the Canadians. Now they just sent down this contingent of like uber. Wait, are these British soldiers or are these Canadian soldiers?
Yeah, everybody here is Brit.
They're not living in Canada.
No, besides the native, the Tecumseh Confederacy, not really seeing people living there.
But I'm just thinking of how terrifying it'd be seeing like these, basically be super soldiers, right?
Yeah.
I don't know how else you describe it. It'd be like watching an army of T2s like come after you.
No, it'd be like being any other country on Earth watching like the 82nd Airborne like show up. You'd be like, crap, this is gonna be bad for us. This is just gonna. We're not winning this.
Okay, burn it down. We'll rebuild it.
It ends up being a pretty short duration. Now, it's important to remember that England didn't really have that many battle-hardened troops that it was willing to send over to the U.S. Because at this point in the war, they've lost influence in the Northwest. Tecumseh's dead. The U.S. Navy is either fighting them to neutrality on the front, on the open ocean, or just literally making it impossible to move troops anywhere in the Great Lakes. And I think a lot of their war strategy was like, oh, we can use the Great Lakes as these highways, and that highway turned into a minefield. The Brits couldn't even maintain control over Lake Ontario. That was seen as like a real, real failure. That was seen as frustrating because they were like, that's our home lake. We should be able to maintain it. And on top of that, the U.S. was freely operating on Lake Erie. So there was always this fear that like, we can't control this massive border, and the U.S. could just line up a bunch of troops. There's no crazy coastal fortifications on the Canadian side of Lake Erie. So they were like, oh, they can just land troops wherever they want on this massive front. Yeah, so the Brits march into D.C., and then they turn into Canadians because now they're committing war crime.
There it is.
So it starts on August 24th. They torch pretty much, it's only public buildings. And the Brits were known as gentlemen during this. Like, there's many accounts of, I don't want to say, quick thing that people make a mistake here is a lot of people say there's primary accounts of the Brits being gentlemen. No, there's not that many. And there's a dispute among historians whether or not there like is that many. Those are first-hand accounts. There are a lot of secondary accounts written in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s, and so on, that talk about it in a retrospective action. And the Brits weren't, there was no looting, there was no assaults, everybody was allowed to leave the house. People were allowed to, you know, if you lived in one of the estates, you wanted to take stuff out, like, they let you do that. They even mockingly, there was a dinner left by Dolly Madison that they mockingly ate.
God, this sounds so Canadian, so polite.
Yeah. Yes, Canadians committing war crimes, but politely.
Politely.
You're here to burn down your home. Is there anything you would like to take?
Please leave.
You haul it out.
God, I love Canada.
We'll be burning down your home, but we will help you move first.
Here's something cool. So they burned down the treasury. They burned down the U.S. Capitol. They burned down the president's mansion, it would later be called the White House. They refused to burn down the U.S. Patent Office.
Oh, probably because there's too much information there they didn't want to lose?
Why the general justified not burning it down was he said that benefits all humanity.
Yeah.
That's
hilarious.
The most Canadian thing in the world. Guys, we're not savages.
at least we know Canada won't cut off its nose to spite its face.
Yeah, right. You know, even when you guys were mean to us, you weren't that mean to us.
I know.
You're like, right. It's going to benefit us. Give it a century. This would be, we're going to be on the right side of this. Canada, long-term investment geniuses.
Right.
Because imagine if you guys were jerks to us. Like, imagine if you were, like, debauchery. Like, that would probably not have been great in the long run.
Oh, can you imagine would Canada even exist if that was the case?
I mean, I don't know, maybe.
It'd be a different look, I think. Yeah, that's what I'm wondering.
But yeah, so they so after so this is all so this happens all August 24th. They burned they even end up burning down the Navy Yard, and then the Americans destroy a bunch of ships that are getting built, so they don't fall into hands. The War Department, State Department end up going on it, going through burning a bunch of stuff. I think one of my favorite parts about this is how it ended.
Mm-hmm.
So fire's all raging, and I believe there were some private homes that got caught up in the fire, and that's where a lot of the stories of the British officers like going out of their way to like evacuate stuff. I don't think it was I think this has been like something long, grayed through history, where it was like the Brits were walking into a home and being like, "Excuse me, miss, let me take all your furniture because I'm burning down your house." No, it was like, "Dude, we burnt down all these large buildings," and then like the poor lady beside like the U.S. Capitol is like, "House is on fire." The Brits are like, "Oh crap! Like we have orders not to hurt civilians and destroy their property."
Right.
So they were like, "Oh, let's get all your stuff out of here. We're sorry." Like, I'm bad.
It sounded like they didn't want to create any long-lasting. I don't know. Like what we were saying, like the relationship between. Yeah, we didn't want to destroy the relationship.
So there's a lot of contemporary historians today, modern historians, I should say, and then historians who wrote a few decades after this, who very much believe that that was the intent of the Brits here. Mm-hmm. You got to also think that these were professional soldiers. These were not militias. These are soldiers who just waged war all across Europe.
They probably just want to go home.
They want to go home, and they also seen enough horrible stuff. Like and the Napoleonic War isn't this war of attrition. I mean, yes, was there scorched earth during during Napoleonic War? Yeah, but that was meant to stop the feeding of armies.
Mm-hmm.
So these guys, these are professionals. They're not. There's no animosity. Like these guys are from England. They probably don't even fully get why they're here doing this.
Right.
Like they fought one battle that routed the enemy. Like. They're not. It's not this 20-year war. They're finally taking over the capital, and then at the end of the day, they're also like, "We don't have enough troops to occupy anything. Like we can't do anything." Right. Like,
4,500.
Yeah, only 4,500 troops.
That's impressive.
Yeah.
Yeah, but 4,500 murder machines, not 4,500 regular people.
True.
Yeah. So then begin to the next day, a massive violent storm comes out of nowhere. And douses all the flames. A tornado happens that ends up killing a bunch of British soldiers.
Oh no!
And it made them actually scatter. Like it made it broke apart the British lines, and the Brits decide to withdraw that night.
So that's all we needed to beat them. We don't need howitzers. We need tornadoes.
I just like the idea. Like if you're. As you guys know, I'm a religious guy, and sometimes, God's a whisper in the wind. Sometimes he's a jet engine. Sometimes he's a tornado and hurricane all hitting you in August in D.C. Like, tell me the last time you heard about a tornado in D.C. or a hurricane hitting D.C.
Right.
Outside of hurricane season.
Yeah.
Like, it's okay, you Canadians, I like you also, but you get your, get out of here. It's not burning stuff.
You've gone so the too Brits, far.
Yeah. So the Brits leave. The Canadians leave. Sorry, I keep saying that incorrectly. The dirty, dirty Canadians who burned down our beautiful capital leave. They keep the patent office in place because they eventually knew that they would be conjoined economically to us, and they would like to have steam engines. So the Brits, the next month, a few weeks after that, September 13th, there's a battle of Fort McHenry. You have Francis Scott Key, all that stuff. Simultaneous to this time, you have William Henry Harrison defeating that. That force coming through Lake Champlain, the Brits just go. We'd already started negotiating a little bit with the Brits. The treaty would eventually become the Treaty of Ghent. But at this point, the Brits and Americans are like, "We're done, right? Like everybody here is done," and the war ends. So they basically burnt DC. We're like, "Okay, let's see how it goes in Baltimore." Baltimore beats them back, and. Then the U.S. Navy sinks all their ships on Lake Champlain, and then they're like, "All right, we're done, right? We're all done."
You
here,
got
right?
some shots. We got some shots. Let's call it a day.
Yeah,
right. They were just done. And that is the story of the War of 1812 in a very, very, very broad sense,
say the least. Oh, Joel, you got any questions or any follow-up things you want to ask before I start wrapping this up?
I think the key things were they burned down York and we burned down Washington.
Yeah, you guys came away better off than us. That was a bigger win for you.
I'd say so, yeah. I mean, I don't know that. You probably wouldn't care if Toronto was gone anyway, would you?
I would care.
As an Albertan.
Go Leafs, go.
Okay, all right. We do still need to do the ranking for James Madison, but we have not actually recorded the previous parts two and parts three yet, so there'll be some continuity shifts here when we come back in just a moment to splice in that portion.
All right, let's go, Kyle. So,
all right.
Kyle usually convinces me that I'm wrong with my ratings, so if we go back and look at the history of this.
Well, that's because I didn't expect you to be so honest with it. I thought for sure I was going to have to be like introducing like offsets for your homerness.
Just like Adam's got an 8 on everything. It's a scale of 1 to 7.
But he did it. You actually gave him like a 2 and a 3. Like you went 7 and then he went 3. And I was like, oh, wait, okay, you can have this 7. I didn't realize you're good. All right, but yeah, so we start off with political influence. So how did Madison do his ability shaping the political landscape, impacting the impact on party dynamics, agendas, long-term political shifts, etc.?
Yeah, so if we talk about his presidency, I would say that was mild. I'd probably give him a 4. Jefferson was still very much in control of the policy. With that said, if we expand that to his entire life and we look at politics, yeah, I would say it's much higher because he wrote the Constitution. If we talk about like constitutionality as a separate thing than politics, which it is, I think an honest interpretation of Madison is that, yeah, was he a flag bearer for his party? Absolutely. But there's no mistaking who was in charge.
Yeah.
Which is Thomas Jefferson.
For the first half.
For the first half, at least. Second half, like the second half.
Yeah. I think you can give him a little bit more on the second half, but yeah. All right, overall governance then, his effectiveness, the administration and implementing policies, managing bureaucracy, maintaining stability and governance.
So one of my only issues I have, and we didn't bring it up during the talk because it's kind of like a what if. He vetoed the bonus bill in 1817. Hmm. And the bonus bill was basically like an infrastructure bill. But if we went through every president that vetoed every bill or...
Okay,
We'd never leave, right? And it's not fair to say the what if. But I do think if you talk about like foresight and you talk about the ability to see something down the future and impact stuff, infrastructure spending is what's most important in an economy. Enforcing contract law, patents, infrastructure spending are probably the most important. So I want to kind of mark him down a little bit on this. I want to give him a 3.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll give you that. Okay, transformational leadership. Has his capacity to enact significant change or reforms that alter the course of history? Did he address pressing societal issues and implement lasting change?
Yeah, I gotta give him a 6 on this, and hear me out. I know that's okay. A little on the high side. There was a war, war ever declared. I don't know if I think we won the War of 1812, but I also think you could argue there's no winners of the War of 1812. It was just
went back to what it was before. Burned down, I don't know how you can say you won it.
We burnt down Toronto or York.
Yeah, but that wasn't Britain.
Yeah, that's true. Burnt down London feels like we'd be much more hated. That would probably hurt the relationship we have with London to today.
Probably because we wouldn't have been nearly as polite about it.
No, we would. Oh, no, absolutely not. Are you kidding me? Oh, Queen, please, let's walk you outside. No, we'd let's burn this down.
Hold her hand.
I do think, huge fan, even though he killed the Second National Bank.
He killed
First National Bank. Bringing the second back, I think that shows immense amount. God, wouldn't we love to have people like that today who see they did something wrong and change their opinion?
Yes. I would argue that that's definitely worthy of a boost.
Yeah. Just absolutely. There's a lot of stuff that Madison did throughout his presidency that reflect that attitude. So I think a 6. I think it was there's a lot of transformation in that case. Yeah. I think if you look at the United States in 1808 versus the United States in 1816, huge difference.
So with that in mind, then, do you want to bump up his governance one? If he left the country better than he took it.
Yeah, that's okay. Yeah, we can throw an extra point on governance.
All right, we'll give him a 4. Then understanding of public needs then. How well do you think he understood and responded to the needs and concerns of the American public? And did they engage with citizens and address their priorities effectively?
What are you saying?
I want to go high on that one, actually.
Yeah, I want to go high on that one, too. Yeah. Like, I was honest, like a 7. Like, I think...
I mean, some of that goes to Dolly, but... I would say some of that goes to Dolly, but I mean, when you're talking about a husband and wife, you're talking about a team.
Like, yeah.
That's a unit. Yeah.
Yeah, I think like back on bill number two, like I think being like, do you know what, we gotta end this. I think if you look at a Secretary of State in Louisiana, I think if you look at early in his life, the Annapolis meetings and stuff like that, like I think he knew what the people wanted, and hey, he was super popular, stupidly, arguably the most popular president to ever live at his time. Like, or maybe Washington's the only person who, but don't forget Washington only won his first term by a handful of electoral votes.
Yeah, but how many people actually voted too, though?
Yeah, the numbers like 20,000 people in the entire United States. Yeah. Hey, don't forget, there's not that many people voting for Madison either. We haven't become that egalitarian yet.
Yeah. All right. What about strategic vision then? How do you want to grade him for his clarity and ambition of his vision for the country?
So I think it's so cool because he got to run the country he wrote the Constitution for. That is awesome. And I know. Listen, anybody who wants to yell at me for saying, James Madison wrote the Constitution. No, it was a bunch of people. Yes, if you've listened to the show, I've not shut up about saying how John Adams doesn't get enough credit for his involvement. The Committee of Five. Yeah, I know. But at the end of the day, the guy who put pen to paper was Madison. And he didn't even agree with everything in the Constitution, which shows how good of a diplomat he was. But I gotta give him a lot of points for this. I really, what do you think, Kyle? I want to hear your opinion on this. You've listened. We've been rambling together for four episodes.
I mean, I don't know how you. What do you knock him down for?
The only thing
you knock him down for is that he was just too married to Jefferson, or he cared too much about what Jefferson thought.
Yeah, I can't think of if I go seven. I can't think of a way to get below that because I'm trying to think of like what was
the only way I get him
flaw.
Below that is that he letting the First National Bank dissolve was a issue that was a holdover from being too caring too much about what Jefferson thought and did.
Yeah, do you want to go six?
I'll go six on that.
Let's go six. I like that.
I'm gonna do 6.5. We haven't done a half yet.
Oh, we do. Yeah, let's do 6.5. Yeah, I'll give that. Right. No, we can do halves.
We can do whatever we want. I put an extra category of boss bitch wife for John Adams last time, so.
And that gave him 87 points, right? Because Abby should have gotten. Yeah.
All right, I think we got through it then.
What are the rankings right now? We have four presidents in.
Let's see, 10. I haven't actually totaled them all. 25. This would be 27.5 for Madison.
No, that's good, dude.
22 for John Adams.
Okay.
Jefferson, 22.
I don't like that those two numbers are the same, but either. How poetic are those two numbers being the same?
No. Yeah, right. And then Washington was probably the highest one, 31.
Yeah, 31, yeah. You know, it's funny. Washington is like people say he wasn't that transformative of a president because of all this other stuff. And we went from being in the United States, George Washington, best president of all time. And it's like, well, actually, look at his administration, blah 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 blah. And like people thought overreacted and tried to suppress him down. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, maybe it wasn't that great. But when you like just look at it, like action for action for action, he's hard to mark down for anything. It's hard to find where. What could he have done better is always the harder question. Yeah,
maybe he could have negotiated a little bit with the rebellion as opposed to showing up with an army.
Yeah, but it's probably good for, if you're a new country and you're nervous and your president rolls up and he's like, yo, stop it. And everybody's like, oh, crap. I just think that would be hilarious if you're like throwing a rebellion. And the president's like, I'm going to put you down. You're like, oh, my bad.
All right. Now that the smoke is cleared, the fires have finally died down. I think it's signaling the end of our time today. We hope to see you next week when we kick off part one of Monroe. But in the meantime, we do want to hear from you. Are you holding any grudges from the War of 1812 like Eric seems to? You can email us at buckstartsherepodcast@gmail.com or you can visit the website buckstartsherepodcast.com. Sub on your favorite platforms to stay up to date. And we will see you all next week.